2013 was another record year for Hollywood at the box office, but was the cinematic product worthy? It's time for the movie critics to take a look back and name our top five films of the year. What was your favorite of 2013? Did you endure a real turkey that you'd like to name as this year's worst flick? We want to hear from you. On the next Central Standard, we'll review movies that debuted in Kansas City theaters over the last month or so, and we'll take a look at what the last 12 months have offered. We'll let you know which titles we think are award-worthy, and maybe name a bomb or two. Join me, Russ Simmons, and my fellow film critics on the next Central Standard. That's coming up right after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, and since I'm sitting here in the host seat, that means it's movie day here on Central Standard Friday, and we're going to be talking about several of the titles that have come out over the last month or so. But also, since this is 2014, we're going to be taking a look back at 2013 and discussing the best and possibly even worst films that came out during that 12-year period. I'd like to welcome you to the show and also my fellow film critics, which include...
Hi, I'm Eric Moline from KCTV5, The Lawrence Journal World, and ScenesDealers.com.
And I'm John Tibbetts. I teach film at the University of Kansas.
And again, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM, and we are here to discuss 2014. So let us know what did you like? What came out that really excited your fancy when you went to the theaters? Yeah, that was a great movie. I'm going to recommend that to my friends. Conversely, was there something that you said, gee, I wish I had that time back, or I had my money back on that one? What was the worst film? We want to hear from you. So give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can also send us an email, centralstandard@kcur.org, and you can also send us a tweet, Facebook, Carrier Pigeon, however you want to contact us, we want to hear from you. So let's jump in first with both feet and talk about some of the films that have opened up over the last month or so. And then after the break, we'll be talking about our top five films of the year. So let's go ahead and chat about the big box office blockbuster that's out right now. It's called The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug.
I don't know what else can be said about this one. I mean, honestly, it's the thing that I find great about the Lord of the Rings movies is re-entering that universe that Peter Jackson has just drawn so wonderfully and so deeply. But what I have to say about the Hobbit films is, beside the fact that they have a lot less plot and interesting characters than the Lord of the Rings films do, probably because he's stretching it out into three books one book into three movies, is the fact that the central conceit is exactly the same. The central conflict is exactly the same. We now have Bilbo Baggins, and he's got the ring, and he puts it on, and it's like, ooh, is he going to turn evil? Is he going to bow to the ring? And it's the exact same conflict that Frodo had, plus the fact that he's on this journey, and he's going with another group of people, and they'll find that the Hobbit is the one to find unlikely courage. And so for me, it's just a retread of exactly the same themes. What's nice about this movie is, at least in the last hour, we get a great sequence when they meet the dragon, and it finally starts to come together as a story, and you realize, yeah, there's a little bit of magic left, and Peter Jackson does have the goods. But I have to say, this is one series that just, you know, it suffers because it pales in comparison to the one before it.
And out of 5 stars, how many would you give it?
I'd give it 2.5.
John?
Well, ironically, one of the best things that works for The Hobbit, for me, is the introduction of Legolas into it, who, of course, isn't in the book. But Orlando Bloom is back and really swashbuckling his way through this one. Who knew this guy was a martial arts expert as well as an ace archer? Mm-hmm. And some of the sequences with him are quite exciting, beautifully choreographed. The sequence with the barrels, and, of course, the sequence with Smaug, and thank you for pronouncing it correctly. truly exciting. Benedict Cumberbatch's voice, along with the voice of the movie Her. We have two of the great voices of all time, apparently working in two movies vastly different. So what works best is what wasn't in the book. What works best is Peter Jackson at his best. Tolkien's book, which was in many ways a cozy fireside tale, is so inflated beyond all recognition that I think a real Tolkien fan may have problems. But if you're an action fan, which is what many of us go for, yeah, it does deliver more than the first one.
And the visuals are really what make this film work, because there isn't a whole lot else. I mean, let's face it. This is extremely padded. When you take a very slight book like The Hobbit and you work it into a film trilogy, with each film being almost 3 hours long, there's going to be a lot of padding. So you better pad it with some pretty good action sequences and some pretty great visuals. And luckily, that's exactly what the production staff has done.
So what you're saying is you're excited for the extended edition on Blu-ray DVD.
Well, I think enough is enough, personally, but it is great visual. It is stunning. If you see it in the theater with 3D, you probably won't regret making that investment.
And the realization of Lake Town. I mean, this is a beautifully detailed, realized area of Middle-earth that we had not seen before because it's invented, like so much else. A wonderfully sweet scene comes and goes all too quickly when Bilbo climbs the tree up through the foliage, and he finds himself in a very sweet, beautiful, sunlit paradise of treetops and clouds and blue skies. And it's so different from the more grim, nightmare-spattered scenes that we have throughout the rest of the film. Mm-hmm. It's this brief glimpse of paradise that kind of keeps everybody going, I guess.
And how many stars out of five would you give it?
I'll give it 3.5.
I'll give it 3.5 as well. And you said 2.5, right, Eric? So let's call it a 3 for The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, rated PG-13. And we've got a caller who wants to tell us about his experience over the last 12 years. There was one movie that he particularly disliked. So we want to welcome on board Dan from Prairie Village. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
The movie that I disliked, and the reason being is it was just slow, no humor, just almost awful plot, was American Hustle. And I know it was all hyped up, and it's got an incredible 3.5 stars in the Kansas City Star today. I was like, oh, my God, you got to be kidding me. I wanted my time back from going to see that one.
Now, you thought the movie was slow?
It was. I mean, it lacked any kind of humor. The funniest part was that, what's the little gal's name?
Amy Adams?
No.
Jennifer Lawrence?
Jennifer Lawrence, yeah. She was about the funniest part. I barely laughed. I mean, she's the best part of that movie.
I kept looking in the credits for a hair wrangler for Jennifer Lawrence's hair.
But what about Christian Bale's hair, vicious comb-over?
The hair was funny. That was about it. It was just a slow, and I felt almost robbed of my $15 or whatever it was to go see it.
Hey, thanks a lot, Dan. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, well, as long as we're talking about American Hustle, let's go ahead and finish it off. Fellas, what did you think?
I've got to disagree with Dan 100%. Yeah. This movie's on my top 10. I had it at number 7 or 8 this year. I can't remember off the top of my head. But this is David O. Russell doing what David O. Russell does. He got a hold of this script. And it was on the blacklist for a really long time about the Abscam scandal, about this corruption going on in the late 70s in New Jersey. And he turned it into something fun and something crazy and satiric and original and something that has his own personality in it. And what I find really, really great about this film is, in addition to the fact, and again, I have to disagree with our caller, that I found it wildly funny and very fast-paced, was the fact that he actually – there's some pathos to these characters. And by the end of the film, I thought maybe this was just going to be a big, broad comedy, and certainly Jennifer Lawrence brings that towards the end of the film. I actually started to feel sorry for these people and get, you know, inside their idea of the American dream and what they thought they deserved. And Amy Adams especially is just so terrific in this movie.
Yeah, it's one of several films where the American dream – what is it anymore? I've been dealing a lot lately with Goethe's Faust, of all things, and the American Dream is really the Faust story. its overreach, its hyperdrive for something we don't have. But then when we get it, disaster will strike. And that was exactly Goethe's point. When you become complacent and you are just fine with everything you have, that's when the end will come. And the end comes for not only the characters here, well, sort of it comes, but in other films that we're going to probably be talking about today. But what a wonderful ensemble piece. I love the narrative trajectory. He's always one step ahead of us. Sometimes we're kind of reaching for, now, what was that again? Who was that? Was he a fake or not? And there'll be a flashback or two that may help us out. But we're ultimately wondering, as the film itself says explicitly, who is it that's conning whom? And what happens when the person presenting the scam is scamming himself? When you believe the con or are conned by the very thing that you are perpetrating on others. This is heavy stuff, and I'll stop there,
yeah.
I think, because it's hilarious. It's very funny. And, yes, Jennifer Lawrence is amazing.
And, you know, I have come to the point, I've seen so many films that I almost always know what they're going to do, what the next step is going to be, and this movie fooled me. And when you can fool me, then you're doing something right. And David O. Russell is definitely doing something right here. And I agree with both of you, everything that you've said, but particularly about the strong ensemble cast. I thought the cast was just terrific. This has got to be one of the strongest ensembles of the year, if not the strongest.
I agree.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and give it a rating, guys, out of five. Eric?
Four.
Four and a half for me.
Four for me. So let's call it four for American Hustle. And if you have a disagreement, let us know. If there's a horrible movie that you saw that you want to warn people away from, or if you want to tout your favorite film of the year, that's what we want you to do. Give us a call at 816-235-2888, or you can send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. Any way you want to get a hold of us, we definitely want to hear from you. And this is a public forum, so we want you to help us warn the public about what's good and bad out in the theaters.
I saw American Hustle at the Plaza, and it was fun watching the audience. Pretty full crowd, but I would say roughly half were maybe aligned along with our caller.
Yeah, sure.
There was a kind of, well, I've been hearing such great things, and where is it on the screen? Mm-hmm. And while the other half is pretty much enjoying things.
Right.
And agreeably being bamboozled a lot of times.
Well, it's definitely...
So there's a real divided quality to that
picture. It's definitely polarizing. And speaking of polarizing, let's go ahead and talk about another one that's extremely polarizing that opened back on December 25th, Christmas Day. Perhaps a lump of coal in your stocking, or maybe not. It's called The Wolf of Wall Street, the latest from Martin Scorsese.
Well, I really loved it. And I think one of the reasons why is because it reminded me so much of what still is his masterpiece, I think, which is Goodfellas. It is narrated by the central character from birth to a dubious retirement. You follow this character's odyssey through a world of high-velocity antics, crime, corruption, you name it, as he engages in another Faustian pact. He wants to get ahead. He wants it all. And in doing so, he sacrifices so much. But in the case of Wolf of Wall Street, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, he was pretty much ready from the get-go to get down in the dirt. Very little screen time is devoted to the young man with high ideals. Humorous sequences as he's being coached by Matthew McConaughey in a very wonderful cameo at the beginning. A lot of chest thumping going on. A new musical trend, Eric.
Yeah.
You might be watching for that.
Okay.
He very quickly falls into the clutches of Wall Street greed. But the movie, also like Goodfellas, has this manic energy running through it that perhaps runs wild. I think in a way, Scorsese is falling victim to what's happening to DiCaprio in the film. The thirst for power, control, the thirst for overreach, excess, I think ultimately may bring Scorsese down a little bit. He may be loosening his grip on the moral center of the picture because it's way too long, way too noisy, way too this, way too that, thoroughly enjoyable all of the time. But by the time DiCaprio and Jonah Hill are literally crawling along the floor because the Quaaludes have gotten of them.
Yeah.
At that point, you're really kind of resisting what you're watching. Like, Marty, maybe this is going a little too far. Are you falling victim to your own cinematic greed here?
Or you're falling under the impression of how it feels to be on those drugs. And, honestly, that scene for me That scene epitomized the entire film. Once that scene ended and I realized what broad comedy and satire they were going for, I did not feel the 3 hours of this film. I was in it from the beginning to the end, and there's been a lot of talk about how it's been romanticized, this kind of behavior. DiCaprio's playing Jordan Belfort, who is a Wall Street guy who committed insane amounts of fraud on a lot of blue-collar people. But I think what this movie portrays is the idea that on one hand, there's this moral center, this moral road that we all walk as human beings on this planet. And sometimes we take detours because it's really attractive sometimes to have all the sex and power and the drugs and those kind of things. These guys took an exit and a left turn, and they went way off the path. And I think the acknowledgement that in human beings, both of these things exist is the strength of the movie. I don't think it's romanticizing it so much as it's challenging you to figure out, you know, in yourself, what do you realize? What can you relate to in this behavior? And everybody's going to have a different answer to that. I thought this movie was amazing. It was my number six of the year.
You know, when you have to go on record to defend your film and say what you're not doing,
yeah,
then there's a flaw. Then you've made a mistake somewhere along the line. I greatly admire Martin Scorsese. I think there are brilliant moments in this film, but I think it's his weakest film.
Oh.
I do, because you look back at his body of work, I don't think that – I think this surely rates toward the bottom of his work, even though it has some great merit. When you have to go on record as saying we're not glamorizing this sort of lifestyle, then you've made a mistake. And it was too much for me. 3 hours of debauchery.
Yeah.
I got it after the first 20 minutes. You know, I didn't have to keep seeing it and keep seeing it and keep seeing it. And also, there are no character arcs in this movie whatsoever. I mean, it's just flat. They don't change. They don't learn from their mistakes. And this is something that I think is another problem that I had with the film.
Yeah, you keep thinking Jonah Hill maybe learning from something that's gone wrong.
He just gets more bizarre.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
It's a treat, though. Like, I've never seen anything like that. Yeah. Film before that character.
I think comparisons with Goodfellas, though, are instructive, because in Goodfellas you had a kind of family unit at the heart of the mobster empire. You had all of the Italian food.
Well, there's a family unit here. It's just really sick.
Yeah. And so you had this idea that he was getting in under his – he was over his head with an authority structure that he was tangling with. Here, the authority structure is less defined. He is the authority structure. He's trying to be.
But there's that scene where he's doing the big Braveheart scene where he's rallying the troops, and he's supposed to be retiring. He's supposed to be admitting that the fun is over, and he talks himself out of it and can't do that. That, for me, epitomized the entire film. That and the one where he looked us straight in the face and said, "You guys don't understand it anyway." That was wow.
We also had someone call in who was going to disagree with us about Wolf of Wall Street. But if you want to give us a ring back, we're anxious to hear from you. And also someone called in about Prisoners, that they thought that was a very good film this year, which I thought was an interesting film.
Relentless, Hugh Jackman, I thought was very impressive. I think it's worth a look.
One of the worst endings of the year, though.
Well, but boy, leading up to that, it was pretty straightforward, pretty relentless, and I respected it for that.
That was Raleigh, who actually called in, who loved that film. He said it was a psychological plot twist film with Hugh Jackman, as you mentioned. I thought it was another strong ensemble cast this year. And Jane writes in with an email that she loved The Lone Ranger and hated Olympus Has Fallen.
I hated Olympus Has Fallen. That was on my worst list. What an insulting movie. It's like it's just action porn set in the Capitol. Horrible.
Well, I loved Lone Ranger's climactic sequence, not in a train, but on top of a train. Probably the best thing of its kind I've ever seen, but as far as the rest of it, no.
Let's go ahead and give our ratings to A Wolf of Wall Street out of 5. Eric?
4.5.
Yeah, 4.5 for me, too.
Well, I'm only going to give it a 3.5, so we'll go ahead and say 4. Is everybody amenable to that?
The sheer energy of the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm. Yeah. And speaking of polarizing movies, let's talk about another polarizing movie, Inside Llewyn Davis. Eric, I know you were particularly enthusiastic about this one.
Yeah, well, I was telling you guys earlier before we started the show that when I made my top 10 list, this wasn't on it. It came in at number 12, but I've seen the movie 3 times now. Mm-hmm. I can't stop thinking about it. And, of course, the music keeps bringing me back. It's set in 1961 in the six-month period. Actually, it's a week period, but in this period where the folk scene hadn't quite blown up yet in Greenwich Village. And pre-Bob Dylan, you have this character character named Llewyn Davis, played so soulfully by Oscar Isaac, in the middle of a Coen Brothers movie that is essentially a very typical nihilistic kind of a caricature type movie. But Oscar Isaac just grounds the whole thing in his artistic journey and his selfishness, and he's an awful person who has awful things happen to him throughout the film. But all of the archetypes, the people he comes into contact with, the beat poet, the Doc Pomus heroin addicted jazz type, the sweater wearing folk singers, and everybody, it's just so beautifully realized and so deadpan funny. And so at first when I saw the film, I thought, wow, there's nothing to it. I just feel horrible at the end of it. Doesn't have a happy ending. But the more I revisit it, the more I like it, and I see all the layers underneath, and the funnier it gets.
Well, those of us that lived through the coffee house, fiery furnace, vanguard era here in Kansas City of the early 60s folk movement, as it were, had a great time with it, too. I mean, all of us are going to find a song or a reference or a location in this film that strikes pay dirt with me. My friend Mary Lou and I were listening to Royal Canal. How long has it been since I've heard that, which read me straight to the Ian and Sylvia classic. Mm-hmm. The sequence, though, with John Goodman, I think is the best thing I've seen all year in any film, in any circumstance. Mm. I don't know if we want to go into detail, but just briefly, it's an odyssey within an odyssey, where our character Llewyn Davis goes to Chicago. He's hitching a ride with some people, one of whom in the back seat is a bloated, overweight, completely spaced out jazz performer, John Goodman, who's complaining that the folk music scene is ignoring all of the wonderful chromatic references. We do jazz. We play all 12 tones of the scale, and you play Jimmy Crack Corn.
Yeah.
That was wonderful, but also scary, because John Goodman can do scary.
Yes,
he can. I mean, if you haven't seen a Barton Fink, then you don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, he's essentially like the Cyclops character that he played in Oh, Brother, Where
Art
Thou?
Very good.
Yeah,
excellent. And that whole sequence, which culminates in a refusal on the part of a producer in Chicago to listen to his music, ain't no money in that. That whole trajectory is as good as anything anybody has ever done in a film. I just watched it with my jaw dropping as minute by minute ticked by. And, oh, what happens to John Goodman?
Yeah.
Guys, wasn't that amazing?
Oh, yeah.
You know, as I watched the film, I was overcome with admiration for these filmmakers. The strength of their storytelling, the strength of their filming, their attention to detail was impeccable. However, they also at the same time challenge you. They don't care if you like the characters. They don't care if you like the story. They're going to present it anyway and just challenge you to react in whatever way you react. And my reaction was, I just don't care. And boy, I tell you, when I saw that movie, I thought, holy cow, here are these great filmmakers, and I wish they'd spend their time on something I cared more about. And I certainly didn't care about anyone in this movie. And that actually knocks it down a couple of notches for me.
Yeah, it was a lot like Fargo for me, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. The first time I saw Fargo, I found it very hard to laugh because it was just so sad and awful. And now I love it. And so I think this is one of those films. You know what I mean?
Let's go ahead and give a rating to Inside Llewyn Davis, guys.
4.
Yeah, 4.5 for me.
And 3, I'll say 3.5 for me. So we'll say, again, another big 4. That's still a positive review for Inside Llewyn Davis, rated R. And Jim has been waiting patiently on the phone from Overland Park and wants to talk about Wolf of Wall Street. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. I got to disagree with you guys on the Wolf of Wall Street. I went and saw that with a group of friends Christmas night, and I couldn't wait to take a shower when I got home. I mean, when you talk about a moral center, I saw no moral center whatsoever with that movie. There was no realization that these blue-collar people did lose their life savings. Nothing about the woman that he hit with his car when he did the Quaaludes thing. You know, there was no consequences, really. The only positive people in the movie were the wife that dumped him and then the FBI guy who Scorsese makes him look like a miserable public servant.
Who ends up his career back in the subway.
Yeah, I didn't see it. It basically, the whole point of the movie was, if you're playing by the rules, you're a chump.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that that's what he was trying to say with the film. And it may be uncomfortable, and it may be something that we don't want to admit, but certainly it's going to challenge the viewer. And I think that's what he was trying to do. So if you felt angry and uncomfortable, then I would say Scorsese was successful.
And don't you come out of a movie like that, maybe the way some did out of August, Osage County? You look at this dysfunctional family for more than 2 hours, and you may be saying to yourself, why do I take time to look at this mess on the screen? Of what good is it?
Right.
Of what value is it? I mean, these are big-time questions you ask yourself when you go to films like this.
And polarizing questions. And Speaking of polarizing, we're going to be talking about our top five films of the year and maybe even talking about a bad film or two after the break. We're going to be taking a short break now, and then we'll have some announcements, and we'll be sharing the best and worst. And we want you to join in on the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, and I'm joined by my fellow film critics today, Eric Moline and John Tibbetts, and we're talking about movies that have come out over the last month or so. And also, very shortly, we're going to be sharing our top five films that we chose this year as the cream of the crop for cinema in, opened in Kansas City in the past year or so. And we want to hear from you as well. So give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can send us a tweet at KCURCST, or also you can send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We'll be taking your calls very shortly. I have a few quick announcements beforehand. And John, I know you have a special announcement that you'd like to make.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. Downtown Library, 10th and Baltimore, currently has on exhibition almost 100 of my paintings. The theme of all these paintings is stargazing. That is, these are all people I've interviewed and drawn or painted or sketched, and these paintings then have been inscribed and autographed by the subjects, subjects including people like Christopher Reeve, Jim Henson, Luciano Pavarotti, John Cage, Ray Bradbury, you name it. And so they're all on display, along with the video installation of some of my video interviews with the people that are also on display. And this is at the 10th and Baltimore Library through the 31st of January. It started last month. And on the 14th at 6:30, that's a Tuesday night, I'm going to be welcoming people who would like to come and talk with me about these paintings, talk some anecdotes about them, and just and kind of enjoy the conviviality of good friends and neighbors who might also enjoy looking at these paintings. And a good friend and neighbor is anybody who wants to come down and look at them, as far as I'm concerned. So thank you very much in advance. But yeah, on display through January, my presentation about them is Tuesday night, the 14th at 6:30. And again, Downtown Public Library, 10th in Baltimore.
And is there some place where they can go for more information? Is there a website?
Yeah, check the website, and certainly on site there's an extensive program. You've got one.
Yeah.
That gives some anecdotes and lists all of the paintings and all of that.
Well, that's great. Congratulations,
John. Yeah, thank you. It's about maybe 30 years' work.
And having seen many of them, it's definitely worth seeing, so I would encourage you all to come out. I have a few more announcements for you as well. The Tivoli Performing Arts Series continues with some of their live broadcast theatrical adaptations. Merrily We Roll Along, Stephen Sondheim's acclaimed musical, will be broadcast from London's West End. It'll be shown January 5th and the 8th, as well as a National Theater Live production of Hamlet, and that's on January 26th. And if you want to find out more information on that, you can always go to kcur.org. We'll have that information for you. And Hollywood's Greatest Year, 1939, at the Kansas City Public Library, is a continuing series that will go throughout 2014. And on January 4th, they'll be screening Ninotchka. On January 11th, the comedy Bachelor Mother. On January 18th, Idiot's Delight. And on January 25th, Only Angels Have Wings. And when you look back at that list of movies that came out in 1939, you say, where did we go wrong from there? Because they were just one amazing movie after another.
And if you do not know Angels Without Wings with Cary Grant and Gene Arthur, run, do not walk, and check this out.
All the screenings will be at the Stanley H. Durwood Film Vault at the Central Library downtown at 14th West 10th in Kansas City. And you can, again, you can find out more information at kcur.org. And finally, Summer in February, a British romantic drama with Dominic Cooper and Emily Browning will be a benefit for the Kansas International Film Festival on January 9th at the Glenwood Arts in Overland Park. Again, we'll have that information for you. We're talking about the best and perhaps worst films of the year. And before we jump back in with both feet, I know that Rhonda has been waiting patiently to chat. Hi, Rhonda. Welcome aboard.
Hi there.
You had a favorite movie of the year?
My favorite movie that I have seen this year has been Ender's Game. I am a diehard Orson Scott Card fan, and if seeing that movie gets even one more person in the world to read his books, I think they're better off for it, and I think they did a beautiful job. It's one of the best book-to-film adaptations I have ever seen.
I was kind of surprised it hasn't fared better at the box office, given the fact that you've got your target audience out there. The Orson Scott Card fans. What happened?
I was absolutely amazed by that.
Yeah, I was hoping that there would be a sequel, but unfortunately, the finances have not been good on that. The box office has been weak, and so the chances of there being a sequel don't look very promising at this point.
Well, I'm hoping it develops some grassroots support later on, hopefully, because I've watched the same stuff with the box office openings, praying that they would do some more. I've read all the books in the series, and I've actually even started listening to the prequels that he's co-authored that are from before the first attack that we see there. But I thought it was an absolutely stunning movie graphically, and they stuck to the book.
All right. Thank you so much, Rhonda. Appreciate your call. And let's go ahead and pick up where we left off, cover a couple of more movies before we start sharing our best of lists. And there was a movie that opened back on December 18th that's doing pretty well at the box office itself, and it's called Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues.
We do have a short amount of time left, so I want to spend as little time as possible on this one. I thought the first Anchorman movie 9 years ago was funny. It's surreal. It's absurd. It breaks the rules of a normal feature film because it's constantly breaking down the narrative. And this one does that as well, but it's 2 hours long. It probably should have been about 90 minutes. And honestly, the joke just gets old, and they fall prey to one of the worst things, one of the most easy pitfalls in the world is to take Steve Carell's character, Brick Tamland, and give him a subplot. This guy is only funny in small doses, and he's incredibly funny in small doses as an absurdist character. But the moment you give him a romantic subplot, it doesn't work at all. And that's just one of many things that was disappointing about this.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. However, at the same time, it did make me laugh. And, you know, I look at a dumb comedy, and you have to say, okay, did they accomplish what they set out to accomplish? And that is, did they make me laugh? And they did. So I got to give it at least a 3 for that.
The gag reel on the DVD Blu-ray will probably be as funny. So I'm giving it a 2.
Okay, so let's call it 2.5 for Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues. And let's quickly talk about another film that's getting some awards buzz. And it's called Saving Mr. Banks, rated PG-13. Yes, John? John is shaking his head.
Hey, nobody loves Walt Disney and the Walt Disney Story more than I do, but perhaps no one is more aware of the shadows and troubling undercurrents of the Walt Disney Story as well. So that leaves me way up in the air on Saving Mr. Banks, a film which in some ways I hated, a film which in some other ways I can respect. But for heaven's sake, it's made by the Disney Studios. It's going to be a whitewash on everything Disney. It's going to make out P.L. Travers to be a very mean-spirited character when, in reality, everything she says, all of her fears about what Walt will do to Mary Poppins were absolutely correct. And I resented the fact that she's being portrayed as some mean eccentric, which she may have been, but she speaks truth. And I've not been a big fan of Mary Poppins anyway. But the movie is trying to justify what's happened, and of course we have her all teary-eyed at the premiere of the film, which did not happen. And we have her visiting Walt Disney's theme park with Walt himself, and so there she is on the merry-go-round, which may or may not have happened. Who cares? So I'm going to be the Grinch here and say I think Saving Mr. Banks is an unfortunate product from the Disney studios, which kind of missed the point of P.L. Travers's participation in that story.
And how many stars would you give it out of 5?
I'll give it 3 stars for Hanks's mustache, but maybe just two.
Eric?
I thought it was a half of a good movie. I really enjoyed the scenes where the songwriters are bringing the music to life and trying to convince Travers, be it true or not, that this is the way to go with the movie. But the subplot, or the other half of the movie with Colin Farrell and the mystery of her childhood, just awful and dreary and dreadful, and it didn't belong in the same picture. So this is a 2.5 for me.
You know, I liked it a little bit better than both of you. I recognize those flaws that you pointed out, which you're right on point, I think, on everything that you've said. The film does tend to get a little treacly. But as the film progressed, I tremendously admired the performances, particularly by Emma Thompson. And I thought Tom Hanks was very gregarious and likable as Walt Disney as well. If you are a fan of Mary Poppins, as I am, you do understand why she's crying. But if you've not seen that film and you're watching Saving Mr. Banks, you're not going to get it, which is, I think, a problem. But at the same time, I enjoyed it quite a bit because I am a Mary Poppins fan. Yeah. So I'm going to give it a 4.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that was just kind of odd that the Hanks characterization was not permitted to get any closer to Walt as we remember, saw him, and heard him.
But you said yourself it's a Disney film, so it's not that surprising.
Yeah, I know. I mean, he was sick. He was old. Mm-hmm. Well, not chronologically so much, but just in every other way. And there could have been drama in that too, Eric. We certainly didn't need to have him going to all the way to Australia. But again, yeah, I'm hoisted on my own petard here.
So
That's what Disney does.
Did you give it? How many stars? Two?
Two.
Two, and Eric, two?
2.5.
2.5, and I'm giving it a 4, so we'll say... so we say 2.5 then for Saving Mr. Banks. Okay, that's
Butch, he's going to hate me out there.
Rated PG-13.
Butch, I'm sorry.
We've got some people that have been responding to us as far as the best and worst of the year. And Mark writes in an email, "I found The Counselor to be a tightly wound morality tale that explores how interrelated the effects of empty greed ripples throughout the aquarium these characters swim through and are set into action. It's mesmerizing, a look at perhaps disarming subtly the movie's construction threw folks off. I'm interested in what you guys think." So what did you think?
I agree with everything he said except the part about it being mesmerizing. It was a rough film to watch. It was an absolute 50-50 for me. I really admired a lot of it.
Ridley Scott can do no wrong.
Well, I felt that the script was really overwrought.
Forced.
Yeah. And this is a kind of dialogue that works better on the page than it does on the screen. It just
crafts,
did not work.
He crafts such a beautiful piece of work in everything he does.
Right. And this, I noticed this has shown up on both best and worst lists. So this has been a very polarizing year. We talked about The Wolf of Wall Street, Llewyn Davis. You know, these
Nebraska.
Exactly. You know, and speaking of Nebraska, we did have someone that called in and liked Nebraska. And let's go ahead and talk to John from Topeka. Hi, John.
Hey, guys.
Welcome aboard.
Hey, thanks.
You wanted to talk about Nebraska?
Yeah, I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts on what you thought of it. I'm a big Alexander Payne fan. I think he does a great job of portraying the Midwest and using characters based in the Midwest. I thought this movie had some flaws and had some big flaws to me, but I still came away loving it. And after I finished watching it, it was just one of those movies. I didn't know why I loved it, but I did. And, yeah, I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts on it.
Okay, thanks for calling, John. Appreciate it.
I think, in a way, it's maybe a Coen Brothers-esque kind of movie, but my problem with it is Bruce Dern. I'm sorry, everybody just loves Bruce Dern, the film of the role of a lifetime, blah, blah. It's a kind of characterization I've seen from others many times before. And how convenient it is that it sometimes... in the story, Bruce Dern will be just completely out of it, spaced out, and incapable of anything. And then at other times, when we need him to be smart and intelligent, then he's right on, and so forth. That roller coaster kind of performance left me nowhere.
He was a man of few words. He spoke only when he needed to. I totally liked the movie. It's on my top 10 list as well, and even liked it better a second time.
Eric only hates it because – he only likes it because I hate it.
That's right. Melancholy.
That's how Eric and I roll.
Is the best word for this film, but in a good way. I liked it as well. Let's quickly talk to Ken, wants to ask us a question from Liberty. Hi, Ken.
Hey, I was wondering if anybody had seen 47 Ronin.
They didn't screen it for critics.
And that's always a bad sign.
Well, I've seen it, and I thought it was an excellent film.
Really?
The
great.
The reviews that I read, the critics all universally panned it. But everybody who saw it almost universally loved it. And I chalk that up to the fact that it's an extremely Japanese film made in an extremely Japanese way. It would be, and the film is, it's like if it's a film about an extremely Japanese subject for an American audience. So it would be like Kurosawa coming to America to make a film about the American Revolution for Japan.
Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, although I've not yet seen it, to say it's extremely Japanese, compare it to the Japanese 47 Ronin of the 50s. And I'm wondering if you might still hold to that opinion.
Well, I've seen parts of the original 1960 film, and that was many years ago. I'm not super familiar. I'm very familiar with the story because in many respects, it's a true story. But it was it's kind of like Kurosawa and Miyazaki meet Peter Jackson.
Hey, thanks so much, Ken. Appreciate your call. Well, let people know that 47 Ronin is actually worth seeing after all. We need to get into our top five lists of the year, and we want to take the time to do that now. But we will be taking your calls at 816-235-2888 here at Central Standard on KCUR. So that'll be coming up very shortly. But go ahead. Let's go ahead and start with you, Eric. Give us your top five films of the year. And let's do it in a dramatic way, starting with five and go backwards.
All right. My number five is Jeff Nichols' Mud, starring Matthew McConaughey, which I think in a matter of years will become a classic American folktale. 12 Years a Slave is my number four. Number three is Her, which is Spike Jonze's new movie coming out next week here in Kansas City with Joaquin Phoenix about the near future and a great, great melancholy romance. Number two is The Act of Killing, a documentary that floored me and that we, as the Kansas City Film Critics Circle, voted best documentary of the year. And number one is Gravity. The most cinematic movie I've seen all year, just an amazing amount of prowess from Alfonso Cuarón, and also with a ton of heart and courage.
And John, what is your top five?
I'm really proud of Eric for Gravity as number one. It was my number two. Also, Act of Killing, my fifth film. I agree with everything about that. Inside Llewyn Davis at four. Philomena at three. I hope we can talk about that. Gravity, number two. And 12 Years a Slave, number one.
And some similarities to our lists, John. Mine at number five was The Hunt, an excellent Danish film that's about a falsely accused teacher. It's a gripping movie that shows what good intentions, when fueled by fear, can have negative implications.
Dark. Yeah.
Stories We Tell at number four, a unique documentary from Canadian actress Sarah Pauley. At number three, Blue is the Warmest Color, which has those controversial sex scenes, but you know what? If you cut them out, it's still a powerfully moving film about two young women who fall in love in France. Number two, Gravity, an expertly crafted film that's one of the best examples of pure visual storytelling you're likely to see. And at number one, 12 Years a Slave, powerful drama. It's both an indictment of human cruelty as well as, you know, a look at individual resilience and dignity, and five very good films. And I'm going to go ahead and quickly share the best top five some of our colleagues who join us here at Central Standard. Tom Poe at number five, he said it was tough, so he kind of copped out and gave us Gravity, Blue Jasmine, Philomena, Nebraska, Mud, and Dallas Buyers Club. But at number four, he has Blue is the Warmest Color. At number three, American Hustle. At number two, Her, the one that also was just mentioned by Eric. And at number one, 12 Years a Slave. And going to Marie Asner. Marie Asner's number five was Captain Phillips. Number four, American Hustle. And number three, Nebraska. And number four, American Hustle. Excuse me, I got that backwards. And number one was All is Lost, and Gravity at number two for Marie. And Lori Lockerbie sent in hers as well. And here in alphabetical order is Lori's list: 12 Years a Slave, The Act of Killing, All is Lost, her, and Inside Llewyn Davis. Sergio writes in an email, I sure do hope that one of your top movies of the year is Gravity. Well, as you heard, it was. As a lover of all things outer space, the movie sure was a treat for me. And Dan writes, Pain and Gain surprised me with how immensely entertaining it was on multiple levels. Deep irony, dark humor, best black comedy I've seen in a long time. I don't think any of us liked it, but I'm glad you did, Dan. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, Eric. I was just going to say there was a lot of movies about the American dream gone wrong this year, and that's the one that I would not recommend.
And I would have to agree with you on that, John.
And I'd like to put in a word about Gravity. Not that it needs it, but the science fiction trappings, the amazing effects, and all of that are wonderful.
And but Paulina is called in from Kansas City with a favorite. And what is your favorite, Paulina?
My favorite is Philomena. I don't know. I don't think you all mentioned that movie. It is absolutely incredible. And I'm sorry if I missed that and the conversation, but I just heard the radio show go on, and I think I really encourage people to really see that movie. It was absolutely incredible. My oldest daughter read the book, and she encouraged me to go see it, and I thought it was just great, a great movie.
Now, oh, boy, do I agree with that. But just to quickly finish my thought, while Gravity has all those things, what it also has most extraordinarily is a sense of how you balance your life, the checks, the balances, the takes, the retakes, the victories, the discouragements on how you get through life, how you stay grounded, and the final scene, the final moments of Gravity bring all of that literally down to earth. And I think those more philosophical aspects of the film are getting lost with all of the effects and everything else. Okay. Now, Philomena, yes, one of the best films of the year, one of the big surprises for me. It came out of nowhere as far as I was concerned. My main thing about that is Steve Coogan, who also wrote the thing.
Right. He wrote himself a good part.
He's the partner of Judi Dench. He's the he's the more materialistic, grounded aspect of that partnership, and he is sensational, and we need him in that picture.
Let's talk to Bill from Olathe, who has a Best Actor pick for us. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I haven't seen all the movies yet, so I don't have a top five of films, but my favorite actors performances so far were Jared Leto in Dallas Buyers Club.
Very good.
Matthew McConaughey in Mud. Tom Hanks, Captain Phillips, particularly the last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Just was riveting. And James Franco in Spring Breakers.
Yeah.
Spring mesmerizing break. Performance.
Yeah.
The film was all right, but he was so good. He made me want to go back and see Oz the Great and Powerful again just to watch him.
Well, Tom Hanks' breakdown at the end of Captain Phillips is amazing.
Hey, thanks, Bill. Appreciate your call. And now let's move on to Al from Ottawa. Hi, Al. Oh, dang it. Al, I apologize. I punched the wrong button. So I accidentally dropped you. Please give us a call back. And if you have a comment, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCURCST. I apologize again for that. Let's go ahead and I'd hate to end this on a negative note, but let's go ahead and talk about our worst films of the year. If you were to pick out one you say stay away from at the video store, John, what would it be?
Well, I have a very perverse take on this worst film thing. So many of them are so easy. Mm-hmm. I will go for the film that's got prestige written all over it, that's supposed to be so great, that totally lost me. So it's my fault. I'm willing to concede that. But All Is Lost with Robert Redford lost me.
Okay, good point.
Sorry.
Eric?
Well, I think that Man of Steel is one of the most dunderheaded ways to reboot a superhero franchise ever, and Zack Snyder was the completely wrong guy for it. But Gangster Squad was the most insulting waste of talent this year.
That was pretty awful. And I'll give you a chance to defend it here, Eric, because I'm going to name Spring Breakers as the worst film of the year. Talk about pretension.
Holy cow. Simmons.
And again, this is one of those films that hits you over the head, and I got it a long time before the film was over. But I'm going to let you go ahead because I know you want to defend it, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, the cinematography is amazing, and the editing. I think this deserves an Oscar for editing because the montage in this film showing us bits and pieces of the same scene out of order, and the reason that you probably hated it was because the characters had very little to say, and they kept saying it over and over again,
yes,
which was kind of the point.
Exactly was the point. Yeah. But that is what irritated me. It says, I get your point, and I realize that you're hitting me over the head with the point, and that's irritating.
And there's a turn about three quarters of the way through the film with James Franco and the way that it ends up, and I just found it to be thrilling and completely unpredictable.
At the far end of all of that is 12 Years a Slave. Not mm-hmm. a discouraging word.
No.
Not a note of dissent.
Right.
This bothers me.
Except for Brad Pitt.
This bothers me. Maybe it's happened already, but I'm kind of waiting for the other leg to drop, the other foot to drop here on 12 Years a Slave.
Let's quickly talk to Khalid. Hi, Khalid. Welcome aboard.
Hello. Thank you so much. I have a top two. First, I'm going to be honest. I've watched my top one, my number one, twice already at the theaters.
I didn't understand.
Number one for me is 12 Years a Slave. Number two is Captain Phillips.
Captain Phillips,
I mean,
yes.
Human stories, really moving and very powerful stories for me. I love Gravity too, but then the human stories for me really want this.
Right. Hey, if you like Captain Phillips, another film you might want to check out is called A Hijacking, which is deals with a very similar subject matter, but it's done from a Danish perspective. A Danish ship is hijacked by Somali pirates. It came out this year. It was very good as well.
Yeah. And the thing is, I'm from Kenya, so there's that correlation. So,
I see.
With Captain Phillips on his way to Mombasa and mm-hmm. Lupita Nyong'o from Kenya, so I love the movies.
Hey, thank you so much, Khalid. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Now we're going to go to Lisa. Lisa calling in from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there, you guys. Love the show this morning. Happy New Year. Let's acknowledge and give a shout-out for Steve McQueen's indie film from the adapted autobiography of Solomon Northrup, 12 Years a Slave. Absolutely knocked it out of the ballpark. I predict Oscar sweeps for the entire ensemble cast, and especially Michael Joseph Fassbender. Oh, my goodness. Incredible in the role of Edwin Epps. And let's look for more from Michael coming up with his new film, Genius, which is in pre-production with Colin Firth. He's also in production right now in New Zealand, shooting Slow West and the character of Silas. And he's also going to be doing Macbeth with Marianne Colliard. Michael Fassbender, 12 Years a Slave. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he was outstanding.
Love it.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Appreciate your call. Go ahead, John, quickly.
Actually, I might put in a discouraging word on 12 Years. Brad Pitt allowing himself to be the angel, saving angel
he didn't
of
write
the story.
It.
He was the producer, though.
He was the producer.
There you go.
You're right. Thank you for joining us. Remember, you can see all of our best and worsts on KCUR.org. And I want to thank my fellow movie critics, John Tibbetts and Eric Moline. Central Standard returns on Monday with a look at Vanity in the new year. Stick around for Up to Date as they take a look at the best offerings in television and more. Our show today was produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz, and our announcer is Lori Arbor. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your weekend.